morning. It's 9:11. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm your host today, David Gustina. No, not Joe Donahue. No, not Ray Graff. They're on some much-needed R&R, and I'll be sitting in today. Be nice, panel. I'm your humble host, and I'm going to do my best here. Let's introduce them this morning. Let's start with our own Alan Shartok.
Hello, humble Dave.
Oh, thank you, sir. And from there to political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post.
Hi, darling.
Oh, darling.
I love you.
I'm so glad you're here, and I love you. And I love Alan, and of course mm-hmm. I love our communications consultant, Teresa Bourgeois, who joins us this morning as well.
And it's just a joy to be here with you today.
Well, and I see you folks each and every time you're here, but I don't get to join you in the conversation, so this makes it extra special. Let's start with something real important, which is, how was your weekend, Alan?
Well, my weekend was very good, holding up little, tiny 5-week-old granddaughter.
Five?
And just you be on your chest, and you go, pat, 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 pat. And she's just so beautiful and so wonderful.
That's great. About the little baby movements that
they make. Just adorable.
Oh, mazel tov.
The real joy of life, right?
It is the real joy of life. It's better than reading in the paper that we are going to see Trump cutting out all contributions to not-for-profits.
As tax deductible,
donations.
And
there are people who do that. I think the WAMC crowd would, never allow this station to go under. And, if they have to give, they'll give. But I don't know that it, I was just talking to Teresa about this. I don't know that they really have the ability to make it happen. Ronald Reagan wanted it too. And then he heard from all of the people who sit on boards and say, "Oh, Ronnie, you can't do this. It'll ruin the St. Louis Art Museum," and like that. So I think that by the time it's all over, they don't get to do that.
Oh, the other issue is, if they do that, then it means also your contributions to your houses of worship will also no longer be tax deductible, which will hit his base quite a bit.
Yeah, you know what, Lib? I don't know that he can't make distinctions, and they can't make distinctions in the
law. Well, it's true, but if they do that and they cut all the social service money, they cut all the program money, and then the 1,000 points of light all get snuffed out by this, because that's exactly what he'll be doing, more people will be dying on the street. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just going to be that simple.
Yeah, I think, given the, if you look at his Trump's proposed budget, deep, deep cuts in the arts, in health, in mm-hmm. education programs, and they say, well, we have to let individuals support this.
Right.
And you say, let individuals support this, and at the same time, you take away their tax benefit. Now, of course, they do have a problem. They still want to pass this deep tax cut that will benefit primarily the top 1%. 80% of the people won't benefit from it at all. And they were counting on the money that they were going to get from cutting health care. Mm-hmm. And so they have to figure out, okay, how are they going to make up the difference? And I don't know, but is this one of the ways they're thinking about is making up the difference? I don't know, because they do have a gap now. They either have to reduce what the tax cut they were planning, or they have to find the money somewhere else, not in health care.
What about just increasing the debt?
Well, that would, if they have a policy philosophy, that would be against their policy philosophy. I mean, it'll be intriguing to see whether or not they can they have to raise the debt limit, but what's their struggle going to be? They were supposed to do that before they went on the August break. And so now they're going to come back from their August break and come right up against the debt limit. And
they like to do it that way.
Right, but it was supposed to be they were able to stretch it out another few weeks. It was the deadline was supposed to be by the beginning of August, and now they've been able to stretch it out. But I don't know if they want to raise the debt even more.
Well, Teresa, I think what you would call for here would be consistency on their part
or a policy.
And they are nothing like that.
Absolutely not.
Now you get their question. What would you rather do? Reward our rich friends, or not raise the debt limit just a little bit more?
But the question is, they put this stuff on the table, so You know, you throw it all out there as a negotiating tool, and then you take it off the table to gain some votes. I just can't imagine. There are some things that will go, but I can't imagine this. Maybe it will.
I'm sorry.
I think the arts cuts will go.
I don't quite understand. What do you mean? Oh, you mean when they negotiate the budget cuts?
Yeah. So you put out a whole range of things, some of which you know you won't ultimately be doing, but you put it out as a bargaining chip.
Sure.
And then you trade for it.
And so it has ever been.
Always.
However, this president we have now is a little bit different from other presidents in that he seems, probably under the guidance of Mr. Bannon, to like chaos and to enjoy it and to throw things up in the air, which I think is more than possible he'll be doing now.
Well, it certainly, as Libby was saying, you know, we were talking about it, it certainly will cause a lot of concern among the groups who are already concerned about impending budget cuts. Think about people who deliver the services to the least of us, the people who are most struggling, whether it's battered women's shelters or education programs or
any
of those host of things. Well, they already, or the arts, local arts programs,
they already know
that cuts are looming.
Yeah, but so what? I'm sorry, but the people who are doing the cutting,
They don't care about them. Not a bit. They don't care about women. They don't care about women who are battered and beaten. They don't.
But I mean,
it's clear. They don't care about the arts. And the issue is, oh, yes, you'll be cutting NEA and the National Humanities Endowment. And then you cut those contributions, the tax-deductible ability of making a charitable contribution. But some of those folks are rich enough that they'll just keep giving. So then these arts institutions, as an example, will end up dependent on, even more so than they are now, on that 1% who can manage to give them money without taking a tax deduction. And so where will art end up in this country? Mm-hmm. It will be, like we were talking about before, there's this connection between this 1% supporting the arts, supporting their version of education, and the dumbing down of America and the narrow perspective of what it means to be in the arts and what arts we should support. And art isn't expression. Art is what I think it should be.
Mm-hmm. What I'm willing to fund. The thing it'll be interesting to me is, do they, if they're so serious about cutting all these tax deductions, what about the business lunch tax deduction? They're going to cut that?
Yeah.
Well, right? They cut them two martinis, didn't they?
You know, I'm hearing daily from mileage. A small group of people who are remonstrating. They are basically saying, look, the stock market is up. And Trump is doing this, too. The stock market is up. The unemployment is doing extremely well, very low in America. We, of course, we all know that this is a trend that started in Obama and even before Obama that has been happening in the United States. Nevertheless, it is what they are saying and shows that everything they're doing, suggesting, and saying is to the good.
Our Alan Scharr talk, followed previously before by Teresa Bourgeois and Libby Post, who are on our panel this morning. You can email us at panel@wamc.org. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Joe Donahue today. Keep your letters short and to the point, of course. No links, right, guys?
No links.
No abbreviations.
No abbreviations. So
proofread your emails before you send them.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah, please.
Please.
Be nice.
We'll be back after this break. And we are back with the roundtable panel, WAMC's Alan Scharr Talk, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois. We, of course, love your letters. Keep them coming. panel@wamc.org. Shortened to the point, and please proofread. We have a letter, by the way.
We do. Nurse Carol.
Oh, yes.
Who is a regular here at Fund Drives and a wonderful friend to the station, wants to know, are political contributions also currently tax deductible? You get a unanimous no on that.
Can I say a no sure. but?
No but, sure.
They're absolutely not. However, a number of nonprofits that people donate to do informational They can't do political advertising,
right?
But they do informational advertising. In fact, there was an interesting story over the weekend about all of these groups who are not-for-profits who are doing a lot of work supporting Donald Trump to try to shore up Donald Trump, all of which are through tax-deductible programs.
Right, they're educating the voters.
Secret donors.
And there's a very fine line between education and advocacy.
It's a USA Today article.
We've also seen the recent reports of politicians, including New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, setting up nonprofits, and the argument is that they're helping him with his campaign as opposed
to
helping
nonprofit
causes.
Speaking of Andrew Cuomo, it is interesting that Jimmy Vielkind, our friend and sometimes correspondent here, has been writing in Politico, right?
That's correct.
That, you know, intimating that maybe Andrew won't run because third terms are tough.
Correct.
And maybe he'll sit it out, the third term effort, and he'll run for president after that, assuming, of course, that he does want to run for president, which he absolutely does. You can take it from me. Okay.
And using the father as the example of, running for the third term.
Yeah, no, he'll do what Papa Mario did. He'll run for the third term.
So on that,
those who suggest he's not going to do it are probably wrong. In any case, he's got a lot of problems. He's got the MTA in New York City. He's got the trial coming up of his best political friends, all of whom may want to stay out of jail one way or another, and you know, become canaries. Who knows? But all of that kind of stuff is going to happen. So I'm just here to say, my advice to Andrew, and as you know, I'm very concerned about him, would be that he, you know, stick it out. He has to run for a third term, and then he'll run for president. He won't win, in my opinion. I don't see who in this country is going to become a big Andrew Cuomo fan at this stage.
Libby, any thoughts?
No.
You got to deal with him?
Remember, he says political consultant / lobbyist.
Yeah. That's the question. Why don't we go to North Korea?
Why don't we not go to North Korea?
I figured I'd get that reaction, but let's talk about it at least. I mean, this was all over the place this morning, of course. The reading from the Times, the United Nations Security Council over the weekend unanimously adopted resolutions to impose the most punishing sanctions yet against North Korea over its repeated defiance of a ban on testing missiles and nuclear bombs. The resolution, intended to press North Korea to renounce its nuclear militarization, could reduce the isolated country's already meager annual export revenue by $1 billion, or about a third of its current total.
And David, we all know that the only important thing about that resolution is that the Chinese voted for it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been thinking about that a lot, thinking without a G, because I want to be seen as a progressive. But but it's clear that the Chinese are in a bad spot. The Americans have just kept saying again and again and again, the Chinese have got to do more. The Chinese keep saying back to the Americans and to everybody else, we haven't got the kind of clout over there with this guy you think we have. It's possible that's true.
Yeah, which weakens their world position.
And it's possible. So by voting no, by voting yes on the resolution, they're basically showing that they have a strained relationship themselves with the North Koreans. Whether it's true or not, I don't know.
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting that here we are, you know, Nikki Haley is actually sort of coming out of her shell and showing some chops with this particular thing. And she's done some other stuff that's been surprising, made some other statements about LGBT people and human rights and stuff like that. And you have John Kelly, and I'm wondering if that change that we thought might happen with this administration of becoming a little more professional, at least for the next few months until he can't take it anymore and he leaves, is actually starting to happen, because she's actually speaking out. She's actually doing something proactive. I mean, I agree with these sanctions. I agree with this resolution. I agree with the Security Council taking action. And so it's an interesting dynamic that there seems to be something going in the air.
Let me say this. You raise another subject which may deviate from the main thread here, but you did say when he leaves, when Kelly leaves. And I say, in the great game of under-over, I'm going to say Kelly leaves at exactly that moment that the president tries to fire Mueller, because mm-hmm. he has to.
Yes, I agree with you. I think I was thinking about this morning. It's his, it's Kelly's credibility and what he stands for.
Okay, so, I'm sorry. Go.
On North Korea, just for people who don't know, under the resolution's provisions, and I'm reading this, all exports of North Korea coal, iron ore, lead, lead ore, seafood will be prohibited. It also imposes new restrictions on North Korea's foreign trade bank and bans the country from increasing the number of workers it sends abroad. So I'm reading that for a reason, because one of these parts of this I don't understand, because Nikki Haley said just before, she said that this will give North Korea's leaders, quote, a taste of the deprivation they have chosen to inflict on the North Korean people. So step back. By all accounts, this is a big win for the Trump administration. Even McFaul and others, who was the Russian ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Russia under Obama, said this is a big win. But the part that I'm a little confused about is, why is this not deprivation to their people who are already suffering? That part I truly don't know. I'm not disagreeing.
Why is
I don't understand.
North Korea concerned about that?
No. Nikki Haley said that this would give North Korea's leaders, quote, a taste of the deprivation they have chosen to inflict on North Korean people, on their own people.
Their own people.
And so that I don't disagree with it. I just don't understand that, because won't this further hurt their own people?
You know what? We have an oppressed population there. They don't dare open their mouths,
right.
Or they'll be whatever. So they're not about to start.
We do have to take a break, not to mention the drought that's going on.
They're starving now, right?
It's a little saber-rattling on Nikki Haley's part.
We'll be back in just a minute with more letters and more conversation. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm sitting in for Joe Donahue today, David Gustino, along with WAMC's Alan Chartok, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois. Boy, you know, we really should have a program dedicated to what gets discussed between.
We were just talking about Mike Pence.
Yeah.
Now think about this guy.
Very interesting.
You know, this guy has been picked by Trump. I think it's demeaning the way that Trump is always sitting in the chair and he's standing up behind him. You know, better they should give him a seat, let him sit down. Now, the New York Times, of course, whether they're starting trouble, as has been claimed by the administration, or not.
Stating facts.
Then they are, in fact, saying that, you know, quietly Pence is thinking about being the president in case Trump gets kicked out. On the other hand, that could be problematic because Trump is not a guy who allows that kind of thing to go on. So in this flurry of post-New York Times thing showing how seriously people are taking it, out comes all these people who say Kellyanne, they trot out Kellyanne Conway to say this is disgraceful, this is awful. The White House writes this is disgraceful, this is awful. Pence says this is disgraceful, this is awful that they're doing it. Hey, when
it seems they do protest too much.
The protesteth too much.
That's right.
So what does it mean?
Well, it really means that put yourself in Mike Pence's place.
Right.
Okay, now it looks like Trump may self-destruct. So on the one hand, you know, you see people like that awful Ted Cruz or other people who will be making, you know, advances mm-hmm. towards this. And you say, I can't let them get ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And I need money in order to run. So I'm going to talk to potential donors. But if Trump catches me at this, I'm a goner. And remember that if Trump does survive and he does feel that that Pence has been disloyal, he doesn't have to pick him for another term. Mm-hmm.
But he can't fire him.
Can't fire him now.
Right, which is, I think, what will infuriate him. If he wants to get rid of Pence and he can't fire him like he can fire everybody else, can you just imagine the temper tantrum that would go on in the White House?
Remember how Spiro Agnew, of course you don't because you're so
yes,
young.
Yes, I do.
You remember how Spiro Agnew got off?
Right.
All of a sudden, miraculously, they found out that he had been a crook
tax evasion.
They found out he'd been a crook when he was the county exec, you know, in Maryland. So out he went. Who knows who whispered what in his ear?
Well, it's interesting. This is the second article, the first one in Politico, about Mike Pence and all the political machinations that he's been involved in. That as his chief of staff, he's brought in this guy, Ayers, who I'm sorry, I can't think of his first name, but why is that a big deal? Well, typically you would have not a political operative. You would have a person who's had a lot of experience mm-hmm. working in government and such, and he has no experience working in government. He's a highly, highly regarded political operative. He just brought him in as his new chief of staff. He has his own separate PAC, Political Action Committee, separate from Trump's PAC. He's been holding meetings regularly at the vice president's home with key donors, some who've been Trump supporters, some who have not been Trump supporters. And then he's been going around the country. So he and others can say, well, this is all part of strengthening the Trump-Pence ticket, and maybe it is, but it also seems a rather independent operation as well. But he's totally intertwined with Trump. It was interesting yesterday to listen to Kellyanne Conway protest very loudly, but she is also the person who went on TV and talked about how General Flynn had the full confidence of President Trump, and hours later he was fired. So
they don't always tell her everything.
They don't always tell her everything.
Well, I think the other point of the article was how early all this is taking mm-hmm. place. And as Alan mentioned, it's not just Pence. It's other folks like Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse and Kasich. And the idea that as we head towards 2018 and what happens in those elections, does that bring more out?
Jeff Flake.
Flake
has been everywhere. Of course, he's selling books.
Yeah, he's running for president.
Basically, he's a conservative. Well, yes, if you're right, you can't run for anything if you haven't written a book.
This is true.
Which is why I wrote Me and Mario. Mm-hmm.
But Senator Flake is very interesting. Mm-hmm. If you listen to what he's been saying,
he will get the attention of
the conservatives.
True conservatives, of people who can't stomach what's going on there but share his politics. I mean, he's positioning himself for a run.
He is a long-time conservative.
Yeah, but what we don't see yet is the movement among the diehards in the polls, among that 33% who would be needed by any of these people to move ahead. These are people who were dyed-in-the-wool, angry people.
But the first step in the process is to go into Iowa and New Hampshire and then also to meet with the money folks. And that's what these guys are doing. They're going into Iowa, they're going into New Hampshire, and they're meeting with the money folks. And this is very, very unusual when you have a sitting president of your own party and you're doing this. Mm-hmm. And if you take this in combination with what the Senate did last week, which I find stunning, which is rather than going to August recess, they decided that they were not going to adjourn. And the reason they're not adjourning, a Republican-controlled U.S. Senate is not going to adjourn because they're concerned that a Republican president might make recess appointments, and they wanted to block that. Now, it's not at all unusual. President Obama, Democrats in the White House, and a Republican-controlled Senate would not adjourn because they want to block, or vice versa. But for the Senate of their own party, highly irregular.
Well, let me just say that's true, and they did do that. But what they haven't done is come up with two bipartisan bills came up to block the firing Mueller. Yeah. And clearly that is the problem, because neither of them passed. They were just suggestions. They were just put out there. So it is certainly possible that he's going to do it. I've always said, as you know, panel, that he has to do it. I've always said that he has to do it. He has no choice. I'm not saying he should do it. I'm saying he has to do it, because if what so many people suspect, that there is something going on in Russia, that Trump's kids weren't lying when they said, oh, we get all the money we need for our projects from the Russians, then, and you have the president of the United States up there saying, I have nothing, I don't know anybody in Russia, I've never done anything, yet his kid says we can get all the money we need from the Russians. What's happened? Now, he took that back, but only under, you know, extraordinary pressure, I'm sure. So if it turns out that he did, that he's been either lying or obfuscating all this time, then I suspect what's going to happen is we're going to have a real mess as he fires Mueller and he fires his own attorney general.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons these folks are positioning themselves.
And Kelly will be gone.
Yeah, because that will be a real demarcation point if he tries to do that. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how Trump reacts to all of these Republicans actively campaigning for president or setting up the infrastructure to campaign for president.
He'll tweet.
It's also going to be interesting. Yeah, by the way, he's tweeting wildly again this morning, so that didn't last.
So much for Kelly.
So much for Kelly, and it didn't last. He's tweeting wildly. But it's also going to be interesting to me to see how these folks are going to campaign. How will people think that you have to campaign in the way that Trump did to become president? Certainly, Senator Flake is taking a different approach. Certainly, Governor Kasich of Ohio is taking a very different approach, actively saying we shouldn't behave that way. But it was also fascinating to the number of bipartisan discussions you saw this weekend on the Sunday shows. Mm-hmm. You saw Governor Kasich and the governor of Colorado, bipartisan coalition. They're going to go around the country talking about health, new ways to reform health care. You saw bipartisan coalition, what you just talked about, Alan, about this effort to block Mueller. Senator Coons, and I'm blocking on the name of the Republican senator he paired with, but there's a number of bipartisan.
In Connecticut, Blumenthal got up there this morning and said he's got a resolution. Well, one that my comment was, well, he's a Democrat, but the more I thought about it, maybe you could get a couple of Republican votes along with him.
So this is one of the things that Donald Trump was tweeting about this morning is Blumenthal. He's really on a rage about Blumenthal.
Yeah, Senator that's scheduled for 11 this morning.
The more rage, the better.
Well, yes and no.
I know yes and no. I mean, from an entertainment point of view, but
Well, this ain't entertainment.
I
but
guess
this is
that,
a guy
but
with his finger on the button.
I know.
This is the president of the United States. Interesting to watch Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut talking about hoax Russian collusion when he was a phony Vietnam con artist. Never in U.S. history has anyone lied or defrauded voters like Senator Richard Blumenthal. He told stories about his Vietnam battles and conquest, how brave he was, and it was all a lie. He cried like a baby and begged for forgiveness like a child. Now he judges collusion.
Kelly must have been on a bathroom break when that got
this
no,
is the
Bannon
president.
Came into the office.
This is the president of the United States of America.
He's demeaning the office.
He's demeaning the office. But also, you think about it. I was thinking about Australia, you know, we had this terrible tragedy where a plane went down, our military service people were killed. And who found that plane? Australia, right? Who did he denigrate, you know, in talking with their prime minister, Australia? You saw Rouhani of Iran gave a talk, you know, had their elections, he gave a talk. And what he talked about, among the things he talked about, is how you cannot trust Donald Trump's word because he makes agreements, the U.S. makes agreements that they don't adhere to anymore.
Look at the conversations with the president of Mexico.
How can you negotiate with him? Think about, so all of these things, the president's words have consequences. If they don't keep agreements, they have long-term consequences, and we need our allies. We don't know what the next tragedy is going to be. And we need our allies, and we need to have a president whose word is...
You know, you make such a good point about all politicians. Those politicians who make hay by attacking colleagues and others across the line, there does come that moment when, you know, John McCain walks into a United States Senate and makes the thumbs down.
Right.
One's got to think that at least some of that comes from having been called a loser because he was captured.
Right. And I think, you know, there are always a lot of heated political debates. They went after each other on policy. But this personal, really deep, horrible person. For the President of the United States to say a U.S. senator cried like a baby and begged for forgiveness like a child, it's just not presidential.
Well, let's hope that your letters that have come in since haven't gotten too personal. We'll be taking those up next after this short break. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC. 9:48 a.m. on a Monday, and you're listening to the Roundtable Panel. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Joe Donahue today. Of course, our Alan Chartok joining us, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois, having discussions this morning. And now you're weighing in, Alan. Some letters.
Okay, from Martin, otherwise known as Marty. Panel, I would like to comment on the recent apparent shift towards professionalism in the administration that was just mentioned. We have seen this before. When Trump gave his congressional speech, everyone lauded it as the moment that he became presidential. That lasted a few days until he made up the Obama wiretapping nonsense. This man cannot contain himself. He will implode, fire Sessions and Mueller, and the vestiges of this administration will abandon him like rats on a sinking ship. From Marty.
Well, Marty, I agree that, but I think we all need to hope for more order in the White House. The stakes are just too high, and the issue's too serious. We do need some order in the White House.
Well, I don't think Marty disagrees with that. Right. He's just prognosticating
they won't last.
What's going to happen,
right.
And I think he's right.
I think you're right, but we hope that there is some more order in the White House.
Mike says, does the panel think sanctions alone will ever work to stop North Korea? China never seems to follow them. That's a very good point that Mike is making, which is that while the Chinese say they're voting for the sanctions, they don't actually, as far as we know, adhere to this, that there have been, you know, there have been some illicit ways of doing business with them, even though they may be saying, okay, you're not going to get any coal anymore.
Well, North Korea...
We're not going to take any coal anymore.
Right. Well, North Korea has not adhered to sanctions previously, but it doesn't mean that this is not an important step that all five agreed. I mean, I think that is, and China and Russia can do other things, you know, use other pressure that they can impose on this.
Okay. Thank you for that, Mike. And then we heard from Betsy, who said, hi, panel. Happy Monday.
Hi, Betsy.
Maybe sanctions, quote, sound right, but will they work? I believe it will make a desperate people and leader more desperate. The people there have no choice but to believe in their leader. So, without diplomacy, I believe these sanctions are doomed. Diplomacy is the key, and so far we have nada. Jill says, good morning, panel.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Aren't there any sanctions we can put on North Korea and any other country we wanted to punish, in quotes, that will hurt the leaders and military and not the already suffering common people? We're all ears.
Right. I mean, that is an interesting question. That's what I was trying to get at earlier. I don't know, unless... you know, it gets at the revenue of some of the key leaders, but the problem is that their population, by all reports, is already suffering terribly. There is a drought, and I know the Chinese are concerned about an uprising and people started fleeing and such. And so this is just the most complex and dangerous situation.
Well, you know, their heavy fist is on the on the population. Nobody dares.
Right.
Caitlin says, raising the debt ceiling is so we can pay for expenses already incurred. It is not the same as increasing the deficit through tax cuts and or spending. It is important to be clear so that listeners are clear. People get confused. I don't support the reactionary GOP tax plans as it will hurt the U.S. people as well as the economy. No, no, no. Listen, Caitlin, here's the way I see it. Technically, you may have a point.
Yes,
But actually... if they want to spend more, or if they want to make sure that people aren't paying, the people at the top aren't paying as much, they're going to have to find that money somewhere, right?
Right. And I think I thought about this before I even saw her note. I was probably, in trying to be brief, I was probably unclear. So if you... they do need to raise the debt limit. That's money that we've already spent, that we owe, you know, we borrowed money, we owe the money.
Right.
We have to raise our debt.
Or we're bankrupt.
Oh, right. And ultimately we've got to do that. The government shut down in the past and the fight over doing that. You would think with a Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican president, that wouldn't be a problem. But by all accounts, it may be a big problem again this year. That is separate than increasing our debt. Because if you don't, if you keep your spending going and, you know, if you don't cut spending and you don't raise taxes, then you increase your debt. And then ultimately you have to borrow.
And of course you have to borrow.
Borrow more. Yeah. And then if you borrow more, you're going to have to raise your debt limit again. So earlier when I was talking, I blended that a little bit too much probably. Sorry.
No, that's fine. And Rich says, real possibility that a clean raise of debt ceiling will not pass. What does the panel think? And that's from Rich.
I think Rich is right.
What? It has to pass.
Well, no. Yeah, a clean one.
There'll be things attached.
Right.
Stuff attached.
Right. No, so he's saying a clean one because that's what they just want, up and down vote on the debt to raise the debt limit. Don't attach anything else to it. That's a bad precedent. A lot of people say don't do that. Just keep it clean. Keep it separate.
But
it
they
used
have
to be
protect
separate.
Their fannies.
But because in the past, the Democrats have been willing to do that. But now with the Republicans in charge, will they be able to muster enough votes to do that, or will they have to add something to it, which would be a bad precedent?
And Peter says, not only do the Republicans hate the arts, they hate the sciences. That's from Peter.
Mm-hmm. We love your letters. Panel at WAMC.org.
There are some Republicans who like the arts, but...
Rockefeller loved the arts,
right.
But he's dead.
And by the way, Rockefeller wanted to be president, and there was no way he was going to be president because he wasn't the right kind of Republican.
Right. Right. Even back then. And that was in the 70s.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And they were dying. I mean, there are the Rockefeller Republicans are now dinosaurs.
But my guess is a lot of the Republicans who like the arts also like their tax deduction for funding the arts. So
I think you're probably right about that. I think, you know, the 1%, they like to go to the Met Gala because they get to rub, you know, elbows with the hoi polloi, or they are the hoi polloi. They rub elbows with one another. Like they like the opera. They like the very high-level arts, which is very important.
Well, there are people who write to me all the time who love the opera.
Right, but I know, I'm not saying that there are people who don't. But I'm saying is that, you know,
I don't.
Those people not getting their tax deductions are not going to be killers compared to somebody like me or you. I give close to 10% of my salary every year, as one is supposed to charity. And, you know, it's a killer because we were able to take it off on our taxes.
And you won't do it if, in fact...
Well, you know, it's we probably will because we believe in what we give to. We are very clear in our giving, and we give to certain organizations that we know need support. So we probably would continue, but, you know, it makes a difference for people. It really, really does. And I think if they go ahead and do this... get rid of the tax exemption for charitable contributions, you will see a precipitous drop in charitable giving.
I mean, think about universities.
Right.
Think about churches. I just, the constituency.
Think about Harvard.
Think about the highest
endowment, I believe, in the country.
Think about synagogues that
alum,
are struggling.
I was just thinking about Harvard as an alum. I mean, they urge you and they talk about the tax deduction or other places.
I feel so sorry for Harvard.
And there's so much that will have to be undone in the tax code, like charitable trusts, all this planned giving opportunities that people have that are all tax deductible. I mean, there's a lot.
Think about all the tax people who, that's their job. People figure out what to donate to.
Every community foundation will tank. I mean, there's a lot of impact.
So is this serious? I mean, is this theater?
Oh, no, I think it's serious. I don't think they're going to get away with it.
I think it's fodder for debate. Fodder for debate so that they can, you know, put it on the table so they can take it off the table. Unless, you know, this notion that they're going to do a one-page tax return. And if they ever got to a one-page tax return, but that's not going to happen.
You know, you can do the 1040 EZ when you don't own a home.
And you see Bill de Blasio in New York City going the opposite direction with wanting to tax the rich over
system. Well, that's a fascinating, complicated thing. There's so much more to that than meets the eye.
How do you figure?
Well, because in the last budget, you all will know the details of this better than me, but New York State budget, one of the things that they did was to extend the quote-unquote millionaire's tax break. It was set to expire. They needed the money, so they extended it. There was an effort to try to get them to expand it. They held off on that. The governor said, well, you know, we're not going to do that. But I think they're waiting to see if all of these federal cuts go through. And then they're going to have a big budget hole that they're going to need to fill. And the easy way to fill that is with the millionaire's tax. So you can't spend that twice, right? So de Blasio is going to try to spend the same money that Cuomo is going to need to spend if the federal government blows a big hole in the tax bill.
That's a lovely relationship between the two men.
Right. I think he's trying to, they're playing a lot of cat and mouse games there.
Right. Right. Well, the subway's a mess, and de Blasio is a populist, and he says, tax the rich.
And they're both being blamed for it by the public.
Cuomo well, yeah, but you know what? The guy who really has taken it in the neck here is Cuomo.
He's Cuomo.
He really has.
And yeah. You know, and that's his own fault because he took all the credit for running the MTA when it was the Second Avenue subway. He went, oh, I did this. And then when the subways began to collapse, he said, no, I don't have enough authority. And everybody looked at him and said, what?
Is there any argument to be made that if Trump was able to go forward with his infrastructure plan and monies came through, that some of this stuff might not have occurred on the state level if we got the federal dollars?
Well, that's if you have a real infrastructure plan with real money behind it that's brick and mortar. And also it depends on where the money comes from. It was interesting. Right. Elaine Chao, she had a fascinating Q&A on C-SPAN this weekend. But she was talking about, in terms of infrastructure funding, you have to be concerned about where the money comes from because you don't want foreign interests controlling your infrastructure. Yeah. And you know, one of the big issues, remember when President Trump went to Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabia Sovereign Wealth Fund is one of the places where they were going to get the money to invest. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, we have to take a break for news, and we'll be back with more roundtable panel very shortly. Don't go anywhere. Coming up on 10:07, you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC, specifically The Roundtable panel. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Joe Donahue for today and tomorrow. Ray will be joining you on Wednesday. We're, of course, here with our Alan Schar talk with communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. And you have sent us more letters. Of course, that's panel at WAMC.org. And a reminder to, Alan, proofread.
Oh, yeah, proofread, because sometimes I don't know whether it's genius or proofreading. And there are some things we just can't read on the radio.
We just can't.
We can't.
So, I've got my finger near the dump button.
Yeah, okay, so I'll read this first one.
Behave.
Dear panel, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and walks like a Richard, then it's a duck. Pence wants to be president. Quack.
You think he does?
You figure it out, folks. What?
Does Pence want to be president?
Of course he wants to be president. That's why people get into politics.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria says...
But, I mean, he's so intertwined with everything Trump has done. Complicit is the word that comes to mind.
Yes.
But his fellow Republicans probably like him better, right?
Oh, yeah.
Unclear. You see, the thing is that Pence is a established politician. Mm. And the reason that so many people love Trump is that he was, quote, one of them. Yeah. One of the richest men in the world was one of them. But that's what they believe. That's what the definition of populism is all about.
But will he do for the U.S. what he did for Indiana?
Or, oh, you mean which they're in big trouble, right?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Okay, so Victoria says, how about the New York State Board of Elections? Why did our Board of Elections cave and send in our information to the President's committee? Thank you.
Because you still have to file the law.
Ahead.
This
it's
is
public.
The file that they sent is a file that anyone can get from any Board of Elections throughout the state in any county. It's your name, address, date of birth, sex, when you registered, your address and all that
but they
sort of
had
stuff.
Asked for more.
And your voting history.
Yeah, not your Social
they
Security
asked for
number.
Social Security number. They asked for a lot more, and they didn't get it. They got what's public.
Yep.
And that's really, you know, and anybody could have gotten it. I mean, you know, I get these files all the time. This is how you do political campaigns. So while I think it's nefarious and what they want to do with the data is pretty ugly, getting it, it's public information.
But the thing that disturbs me is that I've read repeated reports that this activity is frightening people, and so they're taking their names off the voter rolls.
Right.
And that,
by design?
And so, yeah, you know, so. This is just this whole... And let's remember, we have a real problem in this country that the Russians interfered with our elections. And there is no obvious effort to deal with putting in the fire breaks to prevent that from happening. It's happening at the national level. I assume that at state level, folks are working on the problem. Yet we have them working on something that's not a problem, creating a bigger problem.
Okay, this is from Brucey.
Hi, Brucey.
Hey, Brucey.
We hear from Brucey a lot, and a very good correspondent.
She's an old friend.
Is she?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Is Brucey?
Yes.
Yeah, Brucey's a she.
She's a great artist.
Okay.
Really good.
Brucey says, I'm curious about this. Can the president pardon someone before they are accused of a crime or convicted of a crime? I'm wondering how this might factor into the way in which Mueller proceeds. The answer, I believe, is yes, they can. They can give you an absolute pardon for stuff you may or may have, crimes you may have committed.
But not anything in the future.
Well, yes, and no, that's right. Before they accuse, yes, not anything in the
future.
Right,
not in the future.
That's correct.
Right.
Okay. Peter says, I'm a Vietnam vet and resent Trump's fake bone spur to stay out of the draft. That's from Peter.
Uh-huh.
All right. And Alan, why do you think... Oh, no, I'm so sorry. What do you think of the possibility of what we used to call in New York City a fusion ticket? A Democrat and a Republican running on the unity platform. And that's from Rick in Needham. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the Democrats, and here's the problem, are going to be real greedy. I think they can win this one, that this guy's at 33%, you know, 66% of the people hate his guts, and that this is going to be an easy election. And overconfidence has always killed the goose.
Will they pick the right candidate?
What? Yeah.
Well,
the Democrats.
Well, they have to pick the right Democrat, the correct candidate. They have to get the right message.
Who's the they? Will they
the
pick
Democratic
the right
party? I mean,
people like you and me, we're going to have to go into.
But we have the DCC saying choice is no longer a litmus test, and then they're losing women by doing that. I mean, they're not.
The women are going to go and vote for Trump?
No, the women will stay home.
Well,
okay, women will stay home in congressional races where they say it's okay to run a candidate, a Democrat, who doesn't support a woman's right to choose.
Well, of course,
women will stay home.
Of course, I see what you're saying here, Libby. And in congressional races, you may be right. But on the other hand, you know, I think the stakes are so high right now when it comes to presidential candidates. I don't think you're going to find a lot of people on the Democratic side deserting the ticket.
I think you're going to see if they choose a president who is not pro-choice.
They're not going to do that. They're really talking about...
Talking about congressional races.
They're talking about the swing districts where there might be a person who
they want to win.
Who they want to win.
I get
and
that.
I agree with them on this, Libby. Yeah. You know, if it's a person who in that particular district, he or she can win...
It's more important to have as
many Democrats as possible. I'd rather have the majority and lose a couple of votes that won't lose the overall vote if you have them on other issues.
And then you have these Democrats voting with the Republicans to overturn Roe v. Wade.
They're not going to have a majority of people doing that, Libby. It's not going to happen. No. But you cannot run Bernie Sanders progressives in... I'm sorry.
No, you go.
You cannot run. This has got to stop. You cannot run Bernie Sanders progressives in moderate swing districts and think you're going to win those districts. And the Democrats need to win those districts.
They need 218 votes.
Right. If the Democrats are serious, they're going to find the right moderate, to win in those districts.
You can find moderate Democrats who can speak in those swing districts that do not have to give up women's issues. And if choice is the issue, and I know that there are,
I'm just saying you have to have some flexibility.
I think that there are districts where choice will be the issue, but I don't think the Democrat would get elected regardless if they're pro-choice or anti-choice.
Well, if that's the case, but if you have a person who's the strongest possible person to win in that district, and you're going to lose one vote on choice, but you're not going to lose the overall issue. You know, you got to go with the candidate who's going to win in that district, I think.
And
they're not going to be. You're not going to have a Democrat who's against all women's issues. That's just not going to happen.
And as somebody, as somebody who hates to involve myself in these kinds of things because I can only get hurt, I agree with you, Teresa.
Oh.
I think you're right. The main thing now, can you imagine if you could get 218 people and the day that happens in the House of Representatives, Trump is impeached? End of discussion. Now, what? You'd rather be
one vote short of something you're going to win anyway.
Politically correct?
It's not about being politically correct. It's about women's lives and women dying in
back
alleys.
We all agree with that. We all agree with that.
You're not going to lose that. Because what you get, you know, look at all the people. Look at what we got this time. The did not vote party won. Because everybody was nitpicking, oh, Hillary's going to win, or all the Bernie people, oh, she's this, she's that, she, you know, did this, she did that. So they stayed home, they didn't vote because she wasn't the perfect candidate for them. And now Donald Trump's the president. We have 147 new judges in place that are ultra conservative and young, and we have a Supreme Court justice who's going to be there for a long time. So
okay, so Libby says, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Libby, but I don't care.
No, I'm not saying I don't care. I'm saying one of the clear dividing lines from a policy perspective between the Republicans and the Democrats is supporting a woman's right to choose. And I do not want to see that be eroded within the Democratic Party. Now, I don't think they'll put up a presidential candidate.
They never will. Because he or she could not win.
But I've always thought my thing about running for office is, you know, on a local level, you ask the door catcher whether or not they're pro-choice because someday they might be in the assembly or in Congress. And I only want to elect pro-choice candidates, period. That's my thing.
Okay, so you're in some district in Indiana or Ohio.
Where a Republican...
Wait. Can I just...
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I just, finish?
No. Boys and girls.
Okay, So these, you have a chance of getting to your 218 people, and the person comes out and say, well, while I find abortion personally abhorrent, which they do all the time, and I would never practice it, it's the established law of the land. Would that pass muster with you?
Yes, that's the Mario Cuomo litmus test. I'm fine with that. If people personally don't want to have an abortion or, you know, I mean, it's not up to the man, but if a woman personally doesn't want to do it, you know, that's her choice.
So you would...
Yes, I can support that as long as they uphold the sanctity, as far as I'm concerned, of Roe v. Wade.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's go to another letter.
Not all Republicans are Tea Party or Trump people, says Jason. Liberal Republicans still exist. They are trying to snuff us out, but we're here. So Jason is basically saying, I'm a liberal Republican. People are trying to snuff us out, and they are winning. I mean, he's not saying that, but they're still here, says Jason. But we do know that this is something of the past, liberal Republicans.
But he can also switch parties and vote, and that's why he can be, you don't have to switch parties, but you can vote for Democrats in general elections, and he's welcome to vote for the Democrats.
He probably has.
There also was this article about the Trumpism and a lot of Republicans trying to move away from that and not be branded as a sort of a Trumpite. And
that's going to get worse as the numbers go down. The question I have is, now that Kelly is supposedly restoring order in the White House, will the numbers go up? I mean, you know, he's had some victories.
Yes,
let's face it, Trump has had some victories.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly can claim the market. He can claim it. He can claim unemployment. He can claim it, right? You can say, oh, no, that was all Obama or this and that.
But
he can claim it. He can claim North Korea, the vote
and that was a victory.
So the question is, will that be reflected in his numbers? Or will his numbers continue to go down?
my question is if he goes down, if he ends up being impeached or he quits or whatever it is, will that 30%?
Yeah.
Will that 30% end up ever voting again? Because some of these people didn't vote before, and they liked what they heard, so they voted for Trump. So now they're registered voters. So will they vote again?
Well, all I know, Libby, is that in every election, half the country doesn't vote. And in the last election, half the country didn't vote. Right. So it may be a different half the country than was, because there are a lot of ways. There are a lot of ways that that people can vote. They can vote with their by going, and they can vote by not going.
So on the jobs numbers, yes, the job numbers are good. Yes, the stock market's up. But I thought it was interesting. A number of people noted that in President Obama's first 6 months, 1,246,000 jobs created. In Trump's first 6 months, 1,074,000 jobs created. So in fact, President Obama created more jobs than President Trump in the first 6 months.
Okay, they so you're down there out. In the weeds with the wonkers, and you are Willy Wonkers.
Right.
And you know
I'm saying it.
And
that
you
they...
know that, but how many other people know it?
And I'm how just... and they don't no. care. They'll right. just say, look, we've created more than 1 million jobs.
But I think it's important to put those numbers in perspective, which I will keep doing in my
way. Well, you do that.
In my,
we
my
here
way.
At WAMC treasure you.
But, well... Thank you. But there's no doubt that the market's up. Now, the other interesting thing, I was surprised at how people have also talked about how few of his supporters are benefiting from the market, because how few Americans are in the market.
Do they know that? Well, first of all, a lot of Americans are in the market.
Right.
Secondly, do they know it? Do they know that they're not being a beneficiary?
But the fact is, though, they are benefiting from it because, you know, if...
Sure, jobs.
Jobs is... State, you know, there's all different ways that this soaring market helps. I'm fascinated by the soaring market, by the way.
Good morning, says our friend Eric, a wonderful director. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
If Trump gets his way on eliminating tax deductions for donations to not-for-profits, WAMC may be safe, but hundreds of other groups will not. I happen to know Eric is related to one such person who's doing a terrific job, but she has to raise money. The chain reaction of unemployment in an area that fuels downtown economies all over the country will be widespread and disastrous. Another really bad idea. That's right. From Eric.
Yeah. I wonder what the HUD secretary would think about this.
What is that?
Because he's been talking about how even though there are going to be these deep cuts in HUD, that the community has to come in and help sure. out, and the church and the community has to be part of the solution.
Well, so you know, you take a place like that. The Berkshires, where I live, and you see the number of wonderful theater groups.
Imagine
and
what it
everybody
means to them.
Else. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's this huge fight going on over the Berkshire
Museum.
Right now, which are selling their birthright, Rockwell's and other things. In order to survive, you know, basically to get the money to go forward, a place like the Berkshires, boy, that will really be bad.
And the arts community drives the economy in the Berkshires, does
sure.
it not?
Does.
What will happen to Tanglewood?
I was just going to think about
what
that.
What would the loss be?
My dear friend Mark Volpe, I'll be talking to him again on Friday,
what
and I'm
going to
ask
this?
Him that question, okay?
Another just about a minute left,
hospitals.
Alan. Another letter we can
get Not-for-profit hospitals.
Ellen says... Isn't it possible Pence is not so much wanting to run for but preparing to be president? The risk that Trump is getting more and more clear, actions by Republican members of Congress suggest they are moving on, looking out for themselves. Pence cannot just wait to step in should he be asked, in quotes, but be prepared to run for re-election either with or without Trump. And that's from Ellen.
I think that's exactly what he's doing, Ellen.
Yeah,
he's
I
being
agree
prepared
with you.
One way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
We appreciate
he's preparing separately.
All of your letters that have come in, and we apologize for those we couldn't get on. It's panel at WAMC.org. I want to thank our panelists today. Of course, communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and our own Alan Chartok. Guys, this was fun today.
And how about eagle-eyed Liz on the board?
Liz Hill, our engineer.
Watching out.
Right, and you live to tell the tale.
I'm still alive. With any luck, we'll be back tomorrow.
Day one.
Yeah.
Great
you
job.
On the other side, on the other hand, we apologize profusely for having to put up with my lack of a talent hosting this program.
Oh, please. Oh, please.
They love you. Feel the love. Feel the love. They love you.
More the violins. The very tiny.
More roundtable after this.